Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name's Dan.
My name's Joseph.
And today we're talking about Interview with the Vampire.
The Vampire. We were talking before we started recording that conventionally everyone calls it Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense for it to be Interview with the Vampire.
It would be if it was there was only one vampire in the world.
There's multiple. This film is lousy with vampires.
It's
based on the novel by Anne Rice, which was
classic vampire writer.
Global phenomenon.
So was it super popular before the film? Do you know?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. The film would have boosted its popularity.
Sure. Although, yeah, because the film made a lot of money too, but we'll talk about why that's extremely bizarre.
It is very interesting. I should say that this is a film that the second film of our run, which we've watched separately, is it only two?
Yeah, this is the second film that we haven't been sitting next to each other, so I have no...
And we haven't talked about it at all in terms of how we felt about it.
And the last episode we did that on was California, which I start the episode by being like, I can guess exactly what Dan says, he's going to like this film. And you're like, I can guess what... And then we disagree for like an hour and a half. We were completely wrong about how much each would like it.
I reckon we got 80% of each way, actually.
You broke my heart with California. You really did. That sounds like an old, country song.
I left my heart in San Francisco. It's got the same number of syllables.
So the Anne Rice novels, were you exposed to them at all
Zero.
As a teenager?
No.
You weren't really aware of them?
I knew the name Anne Rice. I feel like I knew about this film, but
you
only...
You knew about Lestat the Vampire? You didn't know
I
that?
Did.
Okay.
I knew that going into this film, and I did not know why I knew that.
It's a pretty good vampire name.
It is. L apostrophe? Like... Is that it?
No. L-E-S-T-A-T. Okay. It sounds like if you flipped it backwards, it should... It's like, you know how Dracula, when he's incognito, calls himself Alucard?
I've forgotten that.
What a genius he is.
Pretty
a criminal
good.
Mastermind. My exposure to these books was growing up as a teenager. As regular listeners to this podcast will know, I was a horror nut. I was really into horror. I'd been into horror when I was about 6, and so when I got into high school and I was desperately trying to find other horror nerds, my best point of contact with other people who read horror were people who didn't like most horror but liked the Anne Rice vampire novels. So in particular, I had a friend whose older sister was obsessed with these books, and she was very cool, and I was like, well, I've got to fucking read these things. I read them. They're weird.
Okay.
Probably tell.
Well, as I've established, know very little about Anne Rice.
She's kind of bug nuts. Or not, that's mean.
We might have her on the podcast one day.
Yeah, Anne Rice, if you're listening. She has like a back and forth relationship with religion, which in a lot of ways informs the weird choices she makes throughout her career and her own feelings about her books.
Sure.
Like there's a weird... She writes the screenplay to this film we're talking about today.
Oh,
she adapted her own novel.
That makes sense to me.
And she makes some choices which reflect her changing attitude to the work.
Are you aware of the differences between the film and the novel?
Yes.
Okay.
She's also...
That's why I rely on you. Where would I be without you? This podcast would be a disaster.
No.
Vague speculation.
She talks a lot about her back and forth with this film and with the book in general.
Okay.
But the only context you need to know in the book is that it's like... I actually think, sometimes things are inexplicably popular and you can't really work out why. Rice, I wasn't like overwhelmed by those books. I liked them okay. But the formula is genius, and it's a formula that I think the film capitalizes on that helps the film too, which is just like, vampires are the symbol of the old guard, old European guard. What if we made American vampires like wannabe European vampires, like slightly stepped down, and then you can code all this stuff about like American new money, which is definitely in the film.
Sure.
Like, where is no American aristocracy really? So the film is about like struggling... These aristocrats struggling to define themselves independently.
Mm.
And so is the book.
That's interesting.
So, because I don't know what Dan thinks...
Well, I want to hear what you think, I think.
Should we play the guessing game where we try to work out what the other thinks about the film? Do you want to guess first?
I'll guess first. I think you like this one quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're obsessed with it. I think you enjoy its camp more than anything, and it is spectacularly camp. I mean, it does one of the classic Joseph things, right? Which is, and I think it one of the things it does is it just has these left field events pretty consistently, almost at an even pace. As soon as you think it's going in one direction, it swerves and goes in another. And I think that's something you enjoy a great deal. I think you enjoy the theatricality of the performances and the way in which this film thinks about particularly relationships over time and America as an object, which I guess you kind of said that a little bit. What else?
I don't have a very good poker face, but sure. I'm trying to poker face you a little bit.
That's fine. Okay, I appreciate that. You have a decent poker face.
Very bad at the actual game of poker.
That's interesting. I'll tell you why I think you have a decent poker face, because I think your tells go in both directions. So it can be both. It could be that I'm exactly right, or you have no idea what you're talking about.
That's true.
It's just a slight grin.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. So it's the one tell, but it's a chaotic tell.
Yeah.
I think you really like this film. What might you not like about it? I think you might feel like it doesn't go as hard as it could, and it has this kind of end of history 90s gentility to it that you probably find a bit frustrating, because I feel like 5% 10% changes to this film and you would think it was a masterpiece. That's where I'm at. I can give more, but
okay, I think that's pretty good. Shall I do you now?
Yeah, please.
I think in the case of me, when you get to know me enough, you know that I have, like, fairly specific requirements.
Yeah.
And you know that, like, if it's a film about, like, I don't know, set in World War II and it's got werewolves in it.
Yeah.
You would be aware that, like, I'm probably going to like that film.
Yeah.
Whereas I can't make the same...
I don't know what I want a lot of the time. So I think it would be astonishing if you had a better idea than me, although you do sometimes. But
I'm gonna
I'm unknowable to myself a lot of the time as well. So don't feel bad about that.
I'm going to guess the one that would make me feel most upset.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm wrong, then I get a pleasant surprise. Yeah. And if I'm right, then I've prepared myself.
Yeah.
I think you don't like this film.
Okay.
I think you think it's boring.
Sure.
And I think you think it thinks that it's smarter than it is. And it has a lot of violence in certain parts, which I think you would probably find slightly cruel. Because that's a big Dan tell.
Mm.
I don't know what your face is doing right now. I can't guess. You are like from the 70s a little bit.
I think that's partially because, not to get too deep into it, but my dad was born in 1950. And I think I replicate a lot of my dad. Like, dad is a very self-constructed person in terms of his tastes.
Mm.
And so his time is very influential on him.
I think...
And I think I pick up a lot of that.
I just say that because I'm looking across at you. Dan has the cans on because I make him wear the cans because I hate doing it. It, like, messes with my voice. Yeah. I don't like hearing my own voice. And I'm looking at you and you've got your glasses and your beard and your button-up shirt. And you look like a character in, like, a Robert Altman, like, espionage thriller from the 70s.
No one's ever said anything nicer to me.
Like, you're listening to people next door, spies next door. Yeah, it's very The Conversation.
Oh, man, that's all I ever wanted.
Yeah. I think you just think that this film doesn't really
I get killed enough. 3/4 of the way through the film,
though. Absolutely, yeah, but that's fine.
I'm not
fine,
star, but I'm important. I have some good line readings.
I don't last to the end of any film that's either. Probably true. We're just not the people.
No, here. It's not for us. We've accepted that.
I remember Peter Jackson once said about when casting The Hobbit, he was like, there are just some people who can be elves in movies and some people who can't be elves in movies. And like he said about himself, we're definitely not elves. And Peter Jackson was like, I'm not an elf. Which, like, he's definitely not.
And so that would be a wild Lord of the Rings. I would wonder if I'd prefer that. Lord of the Rings, if all the elves look like Peter Jackson.
Pretty good.
Everything else is exactly the same, but they get to Rivendell. Just a bunch of tubby bearded, like...
Well, Peter Jackson lost a huge amount of weight,
That's true, yeah.
Jackson, I think it's under-discussed the fact that Jackson is obsessed with J.R.R. Tolkien and looks like a hobbit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a slight over-representation of people with names that sound like the job they're doing in those jobs. That's so there's right. a lot of yeah. geographers called Jeff.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's the same thing with Peter Jackson. Possibly.
Sure. I think so. It must. Yeah. I mean, representation, right?
I guess so. I've unsettled myself. I think it's possible that you just think, I mean, the real thing, which is, of course, the exercise of this podcast, is I wonder how much we will differ on the performance of Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people who think this is like one of the saddest performances on film, in that it's an actor feeling sad about having said yes to this film. I mean, we'll get to what I think. I don't think you think that either.
No.
So I think you maybe, I mean, you hate giving star ratings, so I think the star rating you give is like, Joe, I can't give this a star rating. Might be like 1.5 stars.
That's okay.
Should we lay our cards on the table?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I want to say first, though, and this is, we talk about unknowability. I don't know what I would have thought of this film if I had seen it outside the context of this podcast. And my relationship with you, as well as having introduced me to new ways of understanding cinema, which and is something you've done.
I think if I'm watching it next to you, I was thinking this while I was watching the film, and I was like, I think I could convince Dan that we this is a great film. I think I could have gotten your ear. Unless you think it's a great film. Let's lay our cards on the table. You go first.
Here's why I like this film. Kirsten Dunst.
It's an unbelievable performance.
Without that, I might have thought all those things you said. And at the beginning, I'm like, here's my thoughts early on.
Okay.
Why have they cast Brad Pitt in this role? Brad Pitt is physical and he's not doing anything. This is in the first like 15 minutes, right?
I can make an argument for that, but go on.
Although later it changes, right? Yeah. Like when he's burning down the house, I'm like, oh, okay, this is why. I don't recognize Tom Cruise for like 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
You just don't know that it's him?
I knew he was in it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in the opening credits. I just don't... though I knew deep down the stage, I'm like, oh, yes. I mean, so much makeup, right? I'm looking at it and thinking, well, if I turn on the television and someone said, this is Charmed, for the first 10, 15 minutes, I'd be like, yes, correct.
Are we going to disagree? Go on.
I mean, we always disagree. Otherwise, why would anyone listen? As soon as Kirsten Dunst shows up, everything changes for me. It's an extraordinary performance. Her relationship with both of them is really interesting.
It's a queer family. That's one of the reasons I love this film.
Here's something I thought imagined during it. I thought, I bet there's an academic article somewhere about this film called Coming Out of the Coffin.
Yeah.
Because academics love that shit.
If there's not, you should write that.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Yeah, it's a super queer film. I don't know why I didn't mention that. I guess I said it was camp, which it obviously is. But it's also...
There's a story about that queerness. We'll get to it.
Oh, interesting. It's also... I think it's the horniest film we've seen, actually.
It's pretty horny.
Like, there's a lot of... And I know that we've seen a lot of horny films. Horny. But this... The lingering of shots on dynamics that... And I think why this is hornier than The Favourite is because The Favourite is fairly open about its relationships, but this is so repressed in interesting ways.
Yeah.
It's very funny. It's extremely funny. That's something that I'm a little bit disappointed that you would have thought that I would think that this film is smarter than it thinks it is. I think it's exactly as smart as it thinks it is, which is probably not as smart as you think it is.
I would worry that you'd think it was pompous and it had a pomposity to it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is kind of baked into the story.
Yeah, no, I'm fine with that because it's like there's moments. I mean, it's the Dunst montage where like Tom Cruise is mad at her that she ate her dressmaker. It's like, well, where are we going to get someone to make a dress for you?
Yeah.
That stuff is rules. And of course, and the film knows exactly what it's doing there. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think occasionally it's pretty, but for the most part, it's muddy, which I don't love. I know it's a vampire film and it's doing that shit and that's fine, but yeah. But I had a lot of fun during this film. It ends well. The interview stuff I thought was tacked on until the end where I'm like, oh, well, that's fine. The ending justifies the fairly loose framing device of the interview, which doesn't really work.
We'll get into all the specifics because I think we should. Would you like me to lay my...
But I'm recommending this film to people.
Fantastic news. I was worried that that would not be the case.
Yeah, of course.
I'm glad that that's
the case. It's so much fun.
Shall I go for me? So I mean, maybe this is the time to do the sidebar. I think we've said it before. When I'm getting into film properly, I'm about 15 years old, and I get into film in a really kind of like lopsided... I might have even been 14. I was like a young teenager.
Sure.
And I fall into film kind of weird and half like from the side because I just collect these films, most of which are recommended by my dad, others of which are just at the library and catch my eye.
I mean, that's such a fascinating time, right, where you're kind of...
When you can do that, where I'm not... I mean, the internet was around, I'm not that fucking old, but, like, I wasn't... It was a couple of years till I discovered, like, the internet canon.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing is I'm discovering these films and treating the directors of those films like they are major directors, like, reading a lot about them, getting very obsessed about them.
Interesting.
When I am 14... or 15, I watch a film called In the Company of Wolves, which is an adaptation of the short stories of Angela Carter.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very horny and very scary and very weird and doesn't always work, and it's full of incredibly bizarre practical effects. And I'm like, this is the best film ever made. Which back in retrospect seems insane, because you watch that film now and you're like, this is whatever. The man who directed that film is an Irishman named Neil Jordan. So I then print out Neil Jordan's IMDb page, put it in a plastic sleeve because I was such a fucking nerd, know everything about Neil Jordan and watch every Neil Jordan film, one of which is
Interview with the Vampire.
I think we should talk briefly about Jordan context, just because it's wild and a little bit sad in the context of this film. Anyway, so I watch it as a teenager and I'm a little bit iffy on Interview with the Vampire as a teenager. I've read the books by then. I think I prefer the books. I'm like, it's a minor Jordan, which is how I thought of it, which is insane because I think everyone considers all Jordans minor except for his debut, basically.
Sure.
I haven't really watched it in about a decade.
Oh, wow.
Until last night.
Fascinating. That's surprising to me.
I am watching it. I'm like, this is a great film. And then it finishes and it settles so nicely in my memory.
Mm.
I have issues with this film. I have issues with the pacing. It is basically two films stuck back to back.
Well, almost intercut with one another. Yeah. And I'm not talking about the interview, but just it's the journeys of...
Well, Cruise just disappears.
Yeah.
And he's meant to be kind of your lead.
Does that have to do with the book, I wonder?
Or... It's similar in the book. The series of books, Lestat is like the hero of those books. Or anti-hero, really. The Pitt character... is like the narrator through which we see Lestat.
Sure.
It's one of those. It's like a Moby Dick situation.
So the narrator isn't the Christian Slater?
That happens in the book.
Okay.
Yeah, I just mean more that like you're...
It's like the one who's...
the conduit.
He's giving Louis. Us the story. Sure.
I watched it last night. I was like, this is a very good film.
Yeah.
And I really have enjoyed reflecting on it in the hours since
Wonderful.
I've seen it.
It's grown in my estimation.
Yeah, mine
because
too.
I think I was unsettled... The first 15 minutes, I was like, well, this is a bad movie. Why? I remember thinking, I know a lot of people are obsessed with this film, and I started to get it. I mean, I think the first tell is the eroticism between Pitt and Cruise.
Yes.
And the second tell is Kirsten Dunst making everything insane.
It's unbelievable.
It's like, obviously people are obsessed with this. And then the eroticism between Antonio Banderas and Pitt.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that is charged.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the Banderas stuff... Well, maybe we should do the plot. You know, we did... If you listen to our episode on The Favour...
Check it out.
You'll note that we did a game in that where we tasked each other with explaining the plot. I was kind of thinking it would be fun to do that with this film as our overview. Do you want to do that?
Yeah,
sure. And then we can
go
macro.
Man.
Four sentences. Do you want to go first or I'll go first?
So
we'll do the whole plot
easier.
In four sentences. I think it's easier.
I went first last time.
Do you want me to go
you
first?
You go first.
All right. You got to put your fingers up, Dan. I'm a visual learner. I can't do it without your fingers. Dan's got four fingers up, looking even more like a side character in a Robert Altman paranoid espionage thriller. Brad Pitt is a vampire who is telling his life story to a journalist called played by Christian Slater, and recounting in particular his centuries-long relationship with Tom Cruise's Lestat.
That's a solid sentence.
It's a bit
it's lengthy.
Long. An editor would be like, Joe, you need to trim this down.
At least put a semicolon in it.
Pitt and Cruise have had a centuries-long relationship because they're both vampires and they both hate and love each other and are kind of trapped with each other for all eternity. In order to try and ease that pain and boredom, they make themselves a vampire daughter played by Kirsten Dunst, who is then their child and never ages, and she decides she doesn't like Tom Cruise and kills him. Oh, shit.
Yeah, right.
Then Antonio Banderas and Stephen Ree, his assistant, just pop up, take over the film, kill Kirsten Dunst, and Brad Pitt runs off into the sunset and eventually meets Tom Cruise hundreds of years later. Dan's making a face. You didn't like that?
No, I do like that a lot. It's a weird
two
fucking
films.
Film.
It's two films. That's a problem. You get three sentences deep and you're like, oh, and then Antonio Banderas shows up. All right, your turn.
Okay.
Four fingers out.
Pitt in the present day is recounting his history as a vampire to a journalist played by Christian Slater, hinging on his being turned into a vampire by Lestat played by Tom Cruise.
Fantastic.
Lestat and Louis are at crossed purposes over how their vampirism necessarily entails the killing of others, and this causes quite a lot of friction between them.
That's good. I fucking forgot that.
Yeah.
That's a big part. That's most of the first act.
Almost as a way of tying them together, Cruise inducts a 10-year-old girl played by Kirsten Dunst into their family by turning her into a vampire, and she both rebels against this, falls in love with Pitt, attempts to kill Lestat.
One more sentence. And now you've got fucking Antonio Banderas. And that's the thing.
How do you do that in less than...
Because the Antonio Banderas thing doesn't make... I mean, that's loopy. The whole Banderas subplot.
Ultimately leading to Dunst's death, mm-hmm. Pitt and Dunst attend a theatrical performance by Banderas as a vampire and become entrapped in his vampire colony, which is within this theater. And then later Tom Cruise turns up again, and then Tom Cruise also turns up in the present day and bites the journalist that was interviewing Pitt after he's run away from Pitt and again, like driving across the Brooklyn Bridge.
The look of shame on your face as you realize how you're hurrying there. It's coherent in a way, but it's not, you're never watching this film and you're like, what? Where does that come from?
Yeah.
But you certainly are like, oh, I guess we're starting a new film now.
Well, it's also, so I remember thinking, so the second time Lestat is murdered by Dunst, she poisons him by getting him to drink dead blood of children that she's killed.
Which does not. I should point out, sorry to cut you off,
no.
I should point out that I watched this film with Brianna Elton,
yeah.
which is very surprising. Brianna Elton is my fiance. She's invoked on this podcast before. She has extremely changeable tastes.
Yes.
Brianna watched this whole film.
Uh-huh. And she liked
very
it.
Very surprising. I said, what would you give this film? She said 3.5 stars. I tell you, for Brianna,
that is,
she's saying this is a masterpiece for her metric. I could not believe it.
Interesting.
She kept saying to me, what are the rules of vampires in this film?
I
said, I don't know.
Even the sunlight thing isn't really foreshadowed much, so to speak.
I guess you pick up the fact that they're always in darkness.
And he talks about the blue sky.
Well, because he's getting his sunlights from the movies, which is a real nice little point.
Yeah.
Pitt just going to the movies in the middle of the night so he can see the sun again.
Definitely. One thing that is very funny is early on, when Lestat is taking Louis around like a ball or something, and they pinpoint a potential victim, and Lestat says, why don't you read her mind? And he tries, and he's like, I can't.
Yeah, that's it.
That's not referred, it's not like a skill he develops.
Well, it does become a plot point.
Does it?
Banderas' assistant, played by Stephen Ree, which, can I say, I don't know if that's how you pronounce his last name. He's an Irish actor who works with Neil Jordan a lot.
Okay.
I think Dunst is incredible.
Hmm.
Ree is almost as good.
He's very good.
When he shows up and he launches into like a fucking Busby Berkeley dance routine onto the ceiling, it's like...
I love that.
The whole film lights up with
that's
him.
That's true. He's very threatening.
He's real scary. And he reads Pitt's mind and realizes that they've killed Lestat. And that's why they killed Dunst.
Is that made clear?
He says, who's Lestat? And what did you do to him? And then he says, like, you know the vampire code. If you kill another vampire, punishable by death.
I mean, I knew that. I knew that he knew they killed the stat. I assumed they just heard it through the grapevine.
Through the mind grapevine.
That's fascinating.
The mental grapevine.
It also, this film does ask a fair amount of its audience, which is interesting. Not in a bad way, but like the vampires. I watched this with my housemate, and she pointed out a number of things that I missed. I think apparently
did she
Dunst,
like it?
Yeah, she did. Apparently Dunst tiptoes around sunlight at one point, which I didn't realize.
I think she
mentioned that. And there's a few. It was good to watch this with someone because otherwise, I think it would have felt more like a fever dream.
It's a fun film to watch with other people.
Yeah,
it's a good film to like. If you had a gathering of people and you flicked it on, you would have fun, floating in and out of
that,
the plot.
That is interesting because I think something else that was brought to light watching this with someone is you actually do kind of have to concentrate on this film.
You can't really
chat that much.
No.
I'm sure if you'd seen it before, you could definitely have it on in the background.
That's true.
Visually,
actually,
it would be impactful, but there are things that are kind of, like, for instance, I thought that because they were talking about his wife and child dying, Pitt's mm-hmm. Louise, when they find Dunst and they find that woman who, the Dunst's mother is dead.
Yeah.
Because I kind of missed some stuff. I was like, oh, is that Pitt's wife and this is his child that they're making a vampire?
Cruise has a line which makes you think that is quite confusing. Yeah. I remember...
But Alana was like, no, that's not what's happening.
Yeah, I remember having that confusion too. It's a little bit... At certain points, it's a little bit muddled. And the thing that Brianna... As we know, Brianna is someone who, like, has specific questions and requirements about a film. I invoke it all the time, but to me, it's like, it's a shorthand way of describing Brianna's character. She said about Brad Pitt in Ad Astra, she didn't know if he was hot because he looked like he was always looking at reflections. Wonderful. And his own reflection.
That's genuinely transcendent.
She enjoyed the film. She wasn't... Usually, she'll be like... I mean, we watched a film recently called The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is an A24, very Ponzi drama. I didn't like it at all. So Brianna was like, 5 minutes into The Last Black Man in San Francisco, she was like, this is a bad film. I don't like this film. I can't do this film. It's no good. Whereas this film, she didn't say anything for most of the film, which is usually a sign that she's pretty into it. And then suddenly she says to me, how come it's very hard to kill Lestat, mm-hmm. but extremely easy to kill Antonio Banderas's horde of vampires?
In the same way. I thought that as well.
Pitt just has a scythe and is just like chopping people in two.
It's very funny.
That is unbelievable sequence.
That is really good. But I think maybe the two best scenes in the film, sequences in the film, are when Brad Pitt is at first lighting his homestead on fire.
Mm.
And when he's murdering all the vampires. And I think the reason those are the two best scenes in the film and why people are wrong to say that this is necessarily Pitt being sad as actor is because suddenly Pitt's freed up to do stuff physically. And they're the only real times that he has complete autonomy over his body, I think.
That's probably true. And we feel that the body is crucial to Pitt.
Yeah. Especially, I'm not thinking... It will be interesting to see what we think about this when we're, 10 films further down. I think for the first 20 years of his career, it might be it. Like, he sometimes nails emotionality or, like, chemistry or... But...
I don't know if I agree with that. He's slapdash, and he's always going for something with his body. And sometimes that's tied to an emotional moment, and it really works. And sometimes it's just not quite there at the beginning.
I mean,
I love this performance.
Okay, I don't.
It. You don't?
I don't love it. It's good.
You think it's creaky at the beginning?
Yeah.
I don't think that.
Like, the voiceover's bad, and I thought, it's a shame pitchers can't do voiceovers.
That's true.
There's nothing that can convince me that he's doing the best possible job he could of the voiceover. It's like, it feels like he's reading it.
But here's what I think they're thinking about Brad Pitt, and why I think that they're thinking that he's fucking bored. I think Neil Jordan's like, let's cast this charismatic, big, embodied guy who, like, loves to be all over the place and antic and loose with his energy. And let's tell him to dial it all the way in.
Oh, yeah.
So then you're constantly seeing the potential of this guy that is almost never realized. And he's kind of... The point of that character is that he's very quickly... He's depressed with being alive. So Tom Cruise is like, I'm going to bite you and make you a vampire.
He's also a depressed
And then
vampire.
He's super depressed.
And it is depression because... Nothing makes him happy.
No.
Even his love of Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah. He never really seems happy.
There's nothing happens. It's really funny because, like, he'll be given things he wants and he'll just not respond.
He's like a sad Terminator.
Yeah.
He's just like, he's got this kind of woodenness that is drenched in melancholy. You don't like it? I think it's a good performance.
It's a fine performance, and there are elements where, there are moments where it's a great performance. There are large chunks of it that do not work for me.
I wonder too.
Cruise is better.
Cruise is unbelievable. Yeah. Fuck, we got so much to talk about. We've got to be efficient. I wanted to sidebar on Tom Cruise, but I don't know what I'd sidebar to say except for I love him.
Yeah, he's more consistent. We could do a Tom Cruise podcast.
I would love to do that. Yeah. I think he's unbelievably astonishing. He never does a bad performance.
You know what I was thinking? I said this while watching the film. When Cruise is working with Dunst, I was like, I bet Tom Cruise is so good with child actors. I bet off screen he makes them feel comfortable and safe and like... okay with what's happening. I bet he's like really fun to have around. I mean, that's reports are like Tom Cruise is super nice on set, right?
I
know also maybe a maniac who has like imprisoned people before.
Yeah, but
the Scientology
stuff. People, I think the Mission Impossible movies, particularly the most recent three, are among the highest works of art. As taken as a body of work, I think they're amongst the most astonishing achievements of mankind.
Okay.
When I talk about that, I don't like using the word mankind, but humanity.
Yeah, wonderful.
What a stupid word. We need to retire that. I need to retire that. When I try and talk about that online, sometimes people try and cancel me for Tom Cruise. Listen, he fucking has his own belief. Sometimes those beliefs can be harmful when he expresses the anti-psychiatry bit, but for the most part, he's fine.
for the most part, people are just angry with him because he jumped on Oprah's couch.
That's
while,
true.
While promoting Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds, which is an insane fact. Everyone forgets about that incident. He's fine. Leave Tom Cruise alone. Dan's making a face.
What? Wasn't there stuff with Nicole Kidman that was pretty creepy? I don't want to get into it. I don't know. I don't have the data at my fingertips.
He's obviously... Listen, I'm not saying I want to marry Tom Cruise and live with Tom Cruise sure. for 30 years. I'm saying he didn't... There's no... You know...
I'm not looking to... I think he's wonderful in this film.
I think he's wonderful.
I'm not looking for us
star.
To not be able to appreciate Tom Cruise.
No. He is one of America's finest actors. After Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's way better, but Tom Cruise
generally,
is extremely good.
Generally, Brad Pitt's
good.
Better. Yeah.
Tom Cruise is also, I think the...
I mean, yeah.
I think the... What were you going to say?
Is it Ghost Protocol, the most recent one, or what's the most recent Mission Impossible?
Fallout.
Great. Amazing. I saw that at the cinema. It's a good film, not a great film.
Dan.
I know. But Tom Cruise is excellent.
It's obviously one of the films of that year. It just
I enjoyed it a lot.
Is. But it's more... Listen, if what more do
long.
You want than yeah. the Halo jump sequence, filmed for real... Of Tom Cruise jumping out of an aeroplane. That's
I want
what...
the stuff of the heart.
Shush. That moves the heart. That's... Invoke him again. I know it drives you crazy every time I invoke him. That's Immanuel Kant, the 19th century philosopher.
I like Kant.
That's transcendence. That's like awe. Kant says the point sure. of awe is like you're trying to mentally rationalize it and you can't, so you just sit there slack-jawed. That's Tom Cruise jumping for real out of a plane.
I think I want something to reflect on. I guess I can reflect on the fact that Tom Cruise chose to do that.
What? That's all of life is in that sequence.
I like it. I mean, I'm glad he did it. I don't experience the same rush of ecstasy that you do. I'm having a good time.
Or the fucking Burj Khalifa scene in a Ghost Protocol.
Oh yeah, that's what. Where he's climbing on the side of the building. I have seen that film.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Those films are capital G great.
Okay.
Dash. I think the reason why Brad Pitt. Is slighted by people when they're talking about this film. I think he's good. I just think he's good in a different way to the other people. He is surrounded by astonishing performances.
That's true.
Tom Cruise, when you first see him, and you see him in profile, in shadow, in darkness, and he has that Roman Tom Cruise nose, that's the whole character just shown to you in an image.
Yeah.
Everything you know about Lestat is just there. So then you can just enjoy the film because you know that guy totally.
That's true. That is
he's American upper class snob toff who has airs on himself, and there he is.
Who
in
has
a
sophisticated
image.
Moral world that suits himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's a fucking libertarian.
Yeah.
He's an Ayn Rand And
God is dead, and we are God.
Yeah. Exactly. Can I briefly talk about Jordan's career?
Sure.
Is that all right?
I would love nothing more.
I think it is interesting because I think weirdly. So, something I was saying to Brianna while we were watching this film, I think another reason why I was so affectionate for this film is, you know, this film, it cost quite a lot of money. It made so much money. It made 3 times its box office. It made like 220 million.
Its budget, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made like 220 million in like early 90s money.
Oh, why?
It's
so,
weird. Can you imagine if a Marvel movie had the pacing, tone, texture of this film?
The universe of this film, even.
It just doesn't exist anymore. Blockbusters like this, they do not exist.
Is it because nothing else is on? And I don't mean that in any way being down on this film. Just like... And this is kind of what Scorsese says in his Marvel article, right? Is it's not that we're giving people what they want. It's that people are given a limited buffet of options and they will find something within that.
Mm.
And so the fact that people are rushing out to see... It's heartening to me that people are rushing out to see this. And also, like, not to make, you know, people sound like a mindless mass of plebs. But, you know, you go to the cinema, you're like, well, what's on? Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, vampire film. Cool. Like, that's most of the logic behind it. So if it's weird, people are okay with that. People like it. But it's not... I mean, it's not corporate in the sense. I wonder if there are... I bet there are Lestat action figures. There has to be, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But the corporate comment is a good one because I think... The difference.
This is not a movie made by committee.
No.
It's a movie made by, like, maniacs.
The difference between now and then is that back then, what happened was, they're like, Hollywood execs are like, this book, fucking, people love this book. Let's turn it into a movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And maybe none of the execs have read the book.
and they go, you know who's good? Tom Cruise is good. Brad Pitt is good. Neil Jordan's made a couple of like very well-regarded films. Let's chuck them together.
Antonio Banderas seems like a vampire.
Yeah, let's chuck them together and they can do what the fuck they want.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Kathleen Kennedy, although she gets all the hate from like Star Wars.
Yeah, the Star Wars king.
She very carefully brand controls those films. The current Star Wars film. She is firing directors. She is being like, we have to sell toys. We have to work in this market. We have to do this. Nobody's saying that to Neil Jordan. I don't think. I mean, Anne Rice writes the script, as I say. So she's just doing whatever the fuck she wants.
That's something else, actually, that Alana mentioned that I was thinking of during this, is it's very...
Alana, your housemate.
Yeah. Prose-like.
It is.
And I really sense that.
It's very Dickensian.
Yeah.
It's very like, here are some sections from my life.
Yeah.
I want to quickly, briefly do the Jordan. So Jordan is a novelist. He's Irish. He has the craziest career, and it's sad. So I just want to briefly reflect
on... Is Bram Stoker Irish as well?
Bram Stoker is Scottish.
Scottish. I'm so sorry.
Damn. Here we go. Out. Neil Jordan's first film is a really good kind of like low-budget gangster film starring Stephen Ree, who is the... That's definitely not how you pronounce his fucking last name.
How's it spelled?
R-E-A. Ray? Stephen Ray?
Maybe.
Let's just say Stephen Ray, and then I can be wrong twice, because I said Ray all the way before. So he makes Angel, which is like a low-budget Irish gangster drama film, which is pretty good.
Great.
Then he makes The Company of Wolves, so I was talking about the Angela Carter film. Then he makes Mona Lisa, which is another neo-noir stylish, fantastic film, really well-liked, starring Bob Hoskins. Really good film. Then he makes High Spirits, rough. It's like a horror comedy, but this is still, he's just kind of finding himself. Then he makes We're No Angels with Robert De Niro, which is like a gangsters on the run, dress up as fucking priests. It's very weird. It's not very good. We're still in like, he's not nailed it. And then in 1992, he makes the film The Crying Game.
Oh, I've seen that.
Do you like that film?
I don't remember. I think so.
Do you remember the twist?
Yeah.
Did you know about the twist before going
in? Almost certainly.
Oh. Did you?
I feel like that's a very well-known twist.
I didn't, because I watched it when I'm like fucking 14.
Yeah.
It splits my head open. Okay. Do you want to really skip ahead a minute if you don't want to know the twist of The Crying Game? Which you shouldn't, because, I mean, you probably, as Dan's just said, you probably already know.
Like the sixth sense, right? It's one of the major twists. Maybe I didn't. I watched it like 10, 15 years ago.
The twist of The Crying Game is that the character and the audience think that it's a heterosexual relationship, and that's not true. The female love interest is a trans character. And you know two things. That is handled really nicely in the film.
Yeah.
The main character has initially quite a transphobic response. I think he vomits. And then he's fine. He's like, I'm in love. And it becomes like a completely straight down the barrel, completely like nice and politically sensitive love story. Like it really works. Hmm. A big controversy about that film that they're really worried about. So that film makes huge amounts of money, gets nominated for Oscars. They were really worried that the performer was going to be, who plays the love interest, was going to be nominated for an Oscar, because the performer is identified then as male. So then, do they get nominated for Best Actor or Best Actress? And that nomination, getting nominated for Best Actor, would ruin the twist of the film for people who hadn't seen the film yet.
That's fascinating.
It sticks with me that there was this, like, big, like, what do we do? Like, we really don't want him to get nominated for an Oscar. Fascinating.
Huh.
2 years later. So he's just been nominated for a bunch of Oscars, Neil Jordan.
And he gets Interview with the Vampire.
He makes Interview with the Vampire. Unfortunately, I think that cinches his career in a weird way. I think what he needed to do was go away and make like a couple more personal films, because it kind of stops him dead on his tracks from making films like that again. He makes Michael Collins, which is a film about the like an Irish freedom fighter starring Liam Neeson.
Okay. That's
okay. He makes The Butcher Boy, which is an extraordinary horror film. And then here he's doing like The End of the Affair, you know, based on the novel, very stately. He makes In Dreams, which is a serial killer drama starring Robert Downey Jr. And he's still around. But he's making films called, like, Ondine with Colin Farrell, which is about Colin Farrell falling in love with a mermaid.
Oh, and I remember that.
He made Greta, which came out last year, which is Isabelle Huppert falling in love with Chloe Grace Moretz. Maybe it's like a stalker film.
Oh, maybe this is just what he wants to do. That sounds fine. That sounds like a boutique career.
Do you think?
Maybe. If
there's what long gaps, and yeah, he's going to TV and he's making, like, the Borgias and okay, stuff.
Maybe
like
it's not what he wants to be doing.
It's a sad thing that you can make a film that does really well, and for whatever reason it shuts down your career. Unless he's, like, an asshole or something, and that's why that happens to the career.
I mean, it feels like there's no industry like Hollywood for the coherence of a successful career being entirely unknowable.
Yeah.
Like, you can make a studio hundreds of millions of dollars, and that might be a disaster for you personally.
Yeah. Why?
It might be because there are people who say, hey, this book's popular, we should make this, without reading the book. There's just such a disconnect between all the, and all the functionaries, right? Like, there's all the, like, all the separate parts that need to come together for something to work and for everyone to be happy with something, which is not just profit, but, like, you know, the entire making of the movie, its construction, doesn't make for just an easy, obvious career path.
I guess so. But who looks back? I just hope nobody involved look back on this movie with anything other than, like, rosy affection. I guess maybe they would, but, like, this is not...
Probably not. I think it's well-liked. I think it's generally talked about, which is, I think, why I was baffled by the first 15 minutes, because I was surprised.
What was your problem with the first 15 minutes?
It just doesn't seem very good. Like, the voiceover seems poor, it seems, like, contrived, it's quite ugly.
I don't get that ugliness. It's like Barry Lyndon, all the candlelit stuff.
I haven't seen Barry Lyndon. I really want to.
God, you would love that film. I mean,
there are moments of beauty, but I think broadly, like, there's a moment where Pitt on a horse rides into, like, a town, and it's rainy early on, and it looks like just a made-for-TV thing. Like, it's very clearly a Hollywood backlot. The rain looks super fake. I love
the backlot.
Yeah, and that's...
I love the artificiality of the backlot.
That's fine. I get that. But for me, my experience then is, oh, okay, this is, like, a bit half-assed.
Well, I think it's because
again, I change, right? Like, I'm like, oh, this is what the film's doing. What? So that doesn't speak to the quality of the film overall at all. But I was confused about what I generally understood to be a kind of, a minor classic.
I think what Jordan is trying to go for, and maybe he's more or less successful at times, I think what he identifies in Anne Rice's book is, like, oh, this is a sweeping American epic. So he's trying to make Gone with the Wind. And so he wants to be big and artificial and kind of ravishing. And he just populates it with fucking weirdo Hot Topic vampires.
Yeah.
We should briefly... So you weren't at all upset by the violence in this film?
No.
Neither was Brianna. It is quite a violent film.
It's so genre. It's because I think what I do not like about violence is unpredictability. I don't like... Oh, that's not quite true. No, I don't know.
Because then you could watch, like, a slasher.
Yeah, it's true. That's wrong. It's like a painting or something. It didn't feel real.
It's not, quote-unquote, scary, ever. There's violence.
Yeah,
there's no tension.
I wouldn't call this a horror film.
No.
I get why someone would.
It's a sweeping drama that wears the clothes of a horror movie.
Yeah, it has horror tropes, but if I said to someone, oh, there's this great horror film, Interview with the Vampire, I feel like I would be misrepresenting it.
Yeah, that's true. It does contain my least favorite kind of violence, and I found it harder to stomach than Brianna for that reason.
The sunlight?
He kills a dog. He kills two dogs.
You know what? Oh, that's right. Little ones. I don't really think of them as dogs.
I love those little dogs. It's horrible.
You say he killed the woman.
100%.
Yeah.
Dan's making a face.
Played at your trial.
Someone's gonna, yeah, exactly, clip that up. No, I don't mean... I just mean
I know
in terms
mean.
Of on-screen depictions, I hate the violence against animals.
I mean, we could really get into that.
I'm aware that it, like, is tied into a psychopathy.
I mean, all of this, right? For both of us. But no, the violence didn't really upset me. There were moments... I didn't like when that woman wasn't quite dead and they were, like, fighting over killing her.
That's a wild scene.
There was a moment where I flinched, definitely. I cannot remember
Cruise
when.
Cruise uses that little dagger on his fingers to pierce people. You don't like piercing.
I didn't love that, but no, when I flinched was when she... I think was when she bit off the dressmaker's finger.
Oh, yeah. That's a bit yicky.
Because I don't like that.
It's a bit yicky.
Piercing, maiming.
Why do you think you hate piercing?
I got a rusty thumbtack stuck in my foot when I was like 8. Could be that. I'd have a tetanus shot.
Activating incident.
Maybe. It's also
where,
like, who fucking likes piercing?
I mean, some people really like piercing.
What do you mean?
I mean, where was the thumbnail from? Were you running around your house?
Oh, thumbtack.
Thumbtack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
sorry.
Speaking of random language. I did get 3 hours sleep last night.
It was in a friend's backyard. So running around a backyard playing.
What did suddenly, the parents think? Were they embarrassed?
I remember very little about it.
Sure.
I don't even remember being it taken out. I can kind of... I don't have a very visual memory or a very visual imagination, I don't think. I'm finding that increasingly. Like, I'm not... I don't think it's increasing. I just, as I talk to people about imagination, I think I don't have an especially visual one. Thumbtack. I can see the thumbtack in my mind. I know it was rusty. I know I had to go to the doctor and get a tetanus shot. I assume... I don't think it needed to be stitched because...
It just went right in.
It was in my foot, like a bindi. Actually, just 2 days ago. No, I was at the beach and I was walking and there was a burr stuck in my foot and my friend got it out.
Back there?
Yeah. Feet are sensitive.
Yeah.
But there's so little surface area.
There's a canon of so little surface area. You sound like an alien.
Well, they're holding us up. They're holding our whole bodies up. It's fascinating, engineering-wise.
It's true. There's a canon of horror films about piercing, you know. Presumably, you don't want to see any of them. Do you know what happens at the end of Audition? The Japanese horror film.
Tell me. Skip forward a few minutes if you don't want to hear about the end of Audition or hear me squirm.
Audition is a masterpiece.
Okay.
One of the greatest films of the last 40 years, directed by a Japanese director called Takeshi Miike. And the incredible thing about that film is for 80% of its running time, it is a rom-com or like a romantic drama about this widower who is a film producer who loses his wife. And so he wants to find a new wife and he has these very specific guidelines for that. And so his producer friend is like, let's make a fake movie. Say that we're going to make a movie, interview young female actresses, ask for actresses with the specifications you want for a wife. And then you can choose your wife and there won't be a real movie and you can exploit her. And so the film is very neutral about this. It's just showing you these men and it shows you these characters. And they find this woman and she seems nice and the main character is dating her back and forth. And then there's this moment where everything shifts where he calls her and you cut to her house and she's sitting on the floor of her house.
Mm-hmm.
Bowed in front of the telephone, which is just sitting in front of her on the floor, and she's staring at it like she's been sitting there for 6 or 7 hours waiting for him to call. And the phone rings and she picks it up and she answers it and she's like, hello? And then you notice out of focus in the corner of the shot there is a human being stuffed into a bag who's like slowly trying to like work his way out. So you realize she's a serial killer. She at the end of the film ties the main character down and slowly pierces him with like 100 needles while murmuring in this very like high pitchy voice, kiri 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 kiri, which means deeper in Japanese. It's like one of the most unsettling set pieces in horror cinema. And maybe your personal hell.
Yeah, could be.
Would you get inured to it? If I showed that to you on loop for like 50 hours.
It's a really good question, actually.
Do you just eventually go,
Let's do it. Let's start a podcast about that.
About... Go through it second by second. But it's a good... Do you think if I was like... I gave you a horror film, an extremely unpleasant horror film curricula, and you watched it for like months, would be fine?
I genuinely don't know. Because I think back to like things I've seen recently. Like there's a scene in Ready or Not, which we watched together, where a character whose hand, I believe, is already injured gets thrust through a nail.
You talked about it on this podcast. Yeah. That's how much it haunts you.
Yeah, I like don't like thinking about it. And if you said, do you want to watch that again? Having seen it before doesn't make a difference. It
really doesn't?
I just flinched thinking about it. Maybe for the 10th time? I don't think so. It's a physiological reaction.
But surely exposure therapy.
Probably.
I just sound like a fucking sociopath now. I'm going to show my friend Dan horrible images.
I mean, I've watched horror movies before, like, before you were showing me horror movies. I've watched more with you, and they are... Partially they're easier because I think they're often not as bad as I'm imagining them to be. I think as a child, and again, we've had this conversation, so we don't need to have it again, but I imagined horror as this like extraordinarily cruel, constantly. And there's elements of it that are as violent as my imaginings. But a lot of horror films just aren't particularly...
They're fine.
They're not actually that violent. Maybe they have one or two moments of extreme violence in them. But I think I always... Like, there's even in Interview with the Vampire, several times there are kind of moments of violence that the camera, like... turns away from or doesn't pay too close attention to. And I think I had presumed in horror that never happened. It actually happens quite a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The camera just like finds another place to look for a little bit.
Yeah.
We should talk about briefly about a couple of things and then do the Letterboxd game.
Yes.
We have to talk about Kirsten Dunst. Brianna was made aghast.
Yeah.
She is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest performances I've seen.
In a way, I think it's because her character, it's a very good character. It's like, there are certain, you would be like, if you're reading the script, you're like, oh, we could have a lot of fun with the character. Because the idea is that she's like a little prissy girl who never ages and always looks like that. So she becomes this like old soul trapped in a child's body and becomes kind of like an alien. Because she's not even, by the end of the film, you expect her to be like a 70-year-old woman in a child's body, but she's still not. She's still kind of restricted by being in the kid body. It just turns her into a, I don't know, she's scrambled.
There's a marvelous scene where she, in rebellion against having been put in the position she is in by Louis and Lestat, cuts her hair, rushes out of the room, and it has grown back. She says, which one of you did this to me? Another inconsistency in the rules of vampires, because Brad Pitt's hair
it's
changes consistently.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more or less feathered, different parts. Yeah. I'm pretty sure different lengths at times as well.
I think you're probably right. It doesn't really matter.
It genuinely doesn't bother me. I think it's very funny.
Yeah.
I can't believe we haven't talked about Brad Pitt's hair, actually.
There are times where, in the wraparound interview stuff, he's got his hair in like a very tight helmet.
He looks like a finance bro. It's ponytail.
It doesn't look great. When he, like, loosens it in the flashback, he looks real handsome with his hair like that. You don't like it?
It's pretty corny. If I'm seeing a guy like that on the street today...
But you're not. You're seeing Louis the Vampire in, you know... You don't like it?
I think this is a... Well, maybe it's just the makeup. Maybe if we're looking at a more lifeless, vital Brad... A vital Brad Pitt, not lifeless. He's more attractive. Maybe that's it. But I feel like this is one of the least attractive Pitts.
Ranking,
I guess I was never a goth.
Do a ranking of the... I can't imagine goth Daniel Dixon. Holy moly. Can you imagine Daniel Dixon
what
in
am I,
an
big
eyeliner?
Overcoat? Yeah. Oh, I know. Some, yeah.
Do a hotness ranking of the boys in this film for me. Is Banderas the hottest? I don't think...
Tom Cruise.
Really?
Not when he's, you know...
At the end,
through
he
the
looks
wars.
Rough.
He's
the hottest.
Banderas is
hot in this film.
I mean, look, I'm not an expert.
No, but you can give me like an impulsive.
Sure.
Pitt is the least hot, you reckon?
I know, I'm tossing up between Pitt and Banderas is hot.
The hair is
You know
wild.
What? I don't love big square jaws.
You don't think Antonio Banderas is generally hot?
Yeah, he's an attractive man. He's just not my type, I don't think.
Antonio Banderas is, I think, extremely attractive.
Of course Antonio Banderas is an attractive man. It would be insane if I was like, Antonio Banderas, not that attractive, not that appealing. He's beautiful.
He's nowhere
fucking... I just
find
him too threatening. There's that Lisa Simpson joke, right, where she's looking through the magazine of non-threatening boys.
Yeah.
I think that's me.
Really?
Yeah.
Then you should love Timothée Chalamet.
I kind of do.
Really?
Well, okay. No, he's too slick.
Yeah, he's a bit
You want
slick.
Someone with a little nervous, you know? You want Michael Cera.
I don't
want
to get...
I know you hate Michael
killed
Cera.
I do not like Michael Cera. I'm starting to think maybe I don't like Timothée Chalamet, which I'm going to be mobbed
that.
On the street. I just thought he started good and then he... worked with directors who thought that he was better than he was.
That's probably true.
I think he thinks he's the star and he's overacting, which I usually love, in a way that I'm starting to find increasingly insincere. He takes me out of the scene and not in a way that works. I think because directors aren't using him right. I think he needs to play like a low level anxious gangster who steals a scene and then gets shot in the third scene.
Yeah.
He needs to do a couple more of those to reduce the ego, do more character stuff, and I think he'll be better.
He needs to... I mean, I actually haven't seen it yet, The King. But I thought about this before even thinking that The King exists, but I feel like what Chalamet needs to do with his career is do Robert Pattinson.
Yes.
Like, he needs to be in a... Like, Chalamet in High Life is a character that got killed in the first act.
Yes.
Would be great.
Yes.
That would be really interesting.
Well, you know, Pattinson kind of just wanders into The King. You know, he's a bit player in The King.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Opposite
okay.
Timothée Chalamet.
I mean, switch them and it's... I imagine, again, haven't seen
Although
it.
Pattinson is unbelievable in that film. He does a very bad French accent.
I love that for him.
You know who produced The King?
Brad Pitt?
Bradley J. Pitts.
Plan B.
Bradley J loves working with Australian directors. He has two long-standing creative partnerships with Australian directors.
He must have been here.
He must have been here. But I don't think... maybe he hasn't. Well, I mean, he must have at one point.
Even for a tour or something.
But like Andrew Dominik and the director of The King, David Michaud.
Oh, yeah, who made Animal Kingdom, which I really like.
Pretty good film.
I haven't seen his other film.
You haven't seen The Rover?
No.
Starring Robert Pattinson?
I remember it being getting underwhelmed reviews.
It's pretty good. Okay. It has a twist that has stayed with me for a long time because it feeds into my peculiarities as a film watcher.
Sure.
Yeah, but they film those films in America. So maybe he doesn't like often come... I don't know what it is. Bradley Pitts. Who knows him? Who understands him? Yeah,
not us, certainly. I think my sense about Brad...
Go on.
...is that he really likes acting. I mean, we kind of know this, right? Doesn't like... any of the work around acting. No. And that's not just interviews. That's probably like getting to the place, probably even waiting. Well, I mean, a lot of acting is waiting. But I get a sense he's not someone who's tremendously happy with the industry. Which is why that's he's like true. Doing art stuff, doing comedy stuff. Because it's kind of in and out. You get that creative charge. It doesn't have the same structure around it.
I think he burns out on quote-unquote Hollywood as an institution around this film.
Then... Okay, I'm going to go back on what I previously said, though, because then why is he a producer? Is it just that he wants to make it easier for other people?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he likes watching films. That's, I get the sense that he loves... So he loves having a hand in films, but in, like... It's an under-discussed element of Pitt. You know, correctly, rightly, our culture demand that white men, straight cis men in positions of power... use their power and influence to help others and don't make a big show of it.
Yeah.
Pitt is kind of the archetype for that.
It's true.
He doesn't do interviews where he's like, look at me, I've funded all these African-American and female filmmakers. He just does it.
Yeah.
He's producing the new Miranda July film. He produced 12 Years a Slave. He produced The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is a story about African-American experience, even though it was directed by a guy who looks like Justin Bieber's, like, best friend. Weird. We would be remiss to not briefly talk about the queerness in this
film. Oh, for sure. Which is, I mean, I think that was the first place I went in terms of, oh, this is why it's popular. Also, it's just more interesting for its queerness, obviously.
I kind of wish that Pitt and Cruise, like, consummated it a little bit.
Is that happening in 1994? No. Is that when it's made?
No. Yeah. It's just not. I'm aware of that.
Yeah, not that I'm saying that that we forgive it for that necessarily or anything, but like...
If they just slept together in the middle of this film, everything becomes charged.
Well, you know what? Here's what I think. I think the reason it's two movies is because they don't.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, that's obviously where we go next. So we just need another love, like, erotic object, which is Antonio Banderas, and just replace Cruise with that. Because the film can't consummate its third act.
Which is...
So it just has another act... Act one and two.
Which is why if I have a criticism of the film, and my criticisms are fairly minor, like I don't think this is a 5-star film, but increasingly I'm thinking it's like a 4-star film, which for me is like, that's not light, that's like...
I mean, I think it's 3.5 for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
If there's a criticism I have, it's that, so Cruise like pops back up at the end of the film, Pitt runs into him and Cruise is like depleted and wasted and lying in an armchair. There's not enough of a sense that, like, this is two lovers meeting after hundreds of years apart. And I think there needs to be slightly more of that. I was kind of unmoved by that reunion.
Okay.
In a way that I think I needed to just be like, oh, they're back.
Might that be to do with Pitt's performance not being as animated, so to speak, as it could be?
No, because I think this... I take your point, but, like... I feel like that's a really well-acted scene because it does this great thing which is not present in the book, which I think is a Jordan influence. Cruise is like a trauma victim a little bit.
Yeah.
He like shuffles, he's freaked out. It's like, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, I think we've even mentioned this, like pins a lot of pain and shame and angst simply by the virtue of being what he called a thing in the world. Yeah. Simply being observable to other people's subjective experiences is a root and a source of, like, deep pain. That's what Cruise is, and Pitt actually is feeling. I think. Imagine being a thing in the world for hundreds and hundreds of years. Like, just being this object for so long. But, I don't know, it's just not quite there, that scene.
Sure.
Tell you what is quite there. the fucking very end of the film where you have Tom Cruise adjusting his ruffs while driving a car across the bridge.
Yeah, he's back.
Unbelievable.
I knew you'd love that.
It's so good. It is an abrupt tonal shift, but it's so good.
And it also shows exactly what the movie thinks it is.
Yeah.
It reveals the movie to have known all along.
Yeah.
The music as well. They change. He's like, I've had to listen to this whining because the journalist is playing back the tape of his recording of the interview with Brad Pitt. Tom Cruise gets into the car and switches to like an upbeat early 90s
Guns N' Roses. It's Guns N' Roses doing Rolling Stones.
Oh, that's right. It's some Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah. It's so good.
And
yeah, Cruise is like, enough of this shit. Yeah. Like saying enough of the movie. I do think there's a slight like point of irritation between Anne Rice and Neil Jordan, which is kind of interesting. I don't think Anne Rice is tongue-in-cheek about the film in the way that Neil Jordan is.
I bet that's true.
I think he's like, this is a bit ridiculous. And I think if you asked Anne Rice, she's like, this is deathly serious. A few minor things to wrap us up. Anne Rice thought Tom Cruise was a terrible choice for this film.
Oh.
She was extremely vocal in the press about how much she never imagined Cruise as Lestat. She wanted Rutger Hauer. Do you know Rutger?
I do.
He's the baddie from Blade Runner.
That is a totally different film.
Completely different. And Jordan is not the director for that
film. No. I don't know who is. I don't think that's as good a film.
I don't think so. Who is the director
for that film? Because Rutger kind of is vampire-y, isn't he? I mean, someone pretty straight, right?
If you make this film now, who's your ideal director for it?
You know who comes to mind? I'm thinking of two people.
Guadagnino.
And Jordan Peele.
Jordan Peele. Well, I mean, Peele could do the race politics and that's the class true. Politics in this with great sensitivity and intelligence that is not really here in this film. Guadagnino is a real good choice. That makes a lot of sense. You know who I was thinking? Harmony Korine.
Oh, sure. He would... I mean, again, you could have every scene in this film in a Harmony Korine film and just tweak it a little bit and it would make sense.
Yeah, I think so. Do you know Korine in the early 2000s wrote this script for a film about a man who develops a super strong hard glue and he has a pig and he paints it on the feet of his pig and then his pig can climb on the ceiling, and the whole film is about a dude who can like ride a pig upside down.
Right.
And Korine lost the script in a house fire and he was like, it was my magnum opus and I don't have the strength to write it again. What a tragedy.
That's a loss for all of us.
A pig.
Yeah. How does it not get stuck if the glue is super strong?
Dan, you just gotta go with it. In the world of Harmony Korine, you just gotta go with it. Any final words on the film before we do Letterboxd?
I liked it.
I'm so happy.
I'm glad. I just want to make you happy.
As I said, I had 3 hours sleep last night because I did my radio show, which finishes at 4 a.m, and then I woke up at like 7 because the light was streaming in the windows. I was up, you know, mixing songs on the radio, thinking, am I going to have my heart broken by Daniel Dixon?
I don't want to break your heart.
Again.
But I think, yeah, it's flawed.
Sure.
And there are things that it's messy at times.
Sure.
And I don't love that in movies. I want a more coherent vision.
It's not that flawed. It's one of the more coherent and cohesive films we've watched so far.
That's probably true. And also, I mean, thinking about this film, and again, this is about the change scene. We've talked about this a bunch of times. Fascinating how we're essentially, up to this point, watching a random collection of American films.
Yes.
Over a period of like 6-7 years.
Yes.
Really interesting. Like just what turns up, right? And in comparison, how they shine lights on one another. Extraordinary. But it does, when it works, it sings.
It really does.
And so magnificently.
Yeah.
Just like showing me the stuff I want to see, surprising me, giving me a great deal of pleasure and entertainment. And it kind of jumps out at you in a way that I think is really admirable.
The scene, I mean, we referenced it before, but the scene where Pitt decides he's going to kill the Banderas vampire family and he tortures them. He sets them all on fire and then they're flying out of the coffins like on wires.
Yeah, it reminded me of actually one of the reasons I say Guadagnino is it kind of reminded me of the final scene of his remake of Suspiria.
That's true.
This big room and everything is suddenly chaotic and abstracted.
Yeah. That final sequence is the best thing in that film.
I definitely didn't think so at the time, but I could be persuaded.
Because
I
was just of the so shaky unsettled. Cam. It's very weird and people talking directly to the camera.
It's such a choice.
Yeah. He should make more choices.
I didn't think that was bad watching it. I should say, I just didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
I saw that twice.
And you at hated the cinema. It more the second time. We've had
this. I loved it the first time, didn't like it as much the second time.
I don't think I should ever return to that film again. Let's do the Letterboxd reviews. I had so much fun curating these.
I'm excited.
So, I gave it 4 stars. Do you want to know what my review is?
Yeah, of course.
Just batshit.
Yeah, bat. It's a vampire pun.
I was also going to say my review was also just going to be goth soup.
Oh, that's good. That's true.
What do you think the rating spread is for this film? What's the average rating?
3.7.
3.5. Everyone agrees with you. So,
I mean, that's not how averages work exactly.
That's exactly how they work. So I want to do a couple of my friends, and then and then we'll do some more. So this is my friend Brian Eno.
Oh yeah, of course, the real ambient composer. Yeah, yeah, I know him well.
No, they're a real friend from real life. Their favorite film. They have one listed favorite film. It's called Augsburger Puppenkiste Katz mit Hut. It's a German film with puppets. I can't tell you anything more about it. It's got this fucking scary cat puppet.
Horrifying.
Yeah. How many people have seen it? 42.
Yep.
So, funny joke. I like it. Fantastic bio on Brian Eno. Only movie I like is The Wicker Man, 1973. Great film.
It's a very good film.
Great film. So sad. Spoiler alert. I think something that for some reason rings in my ears is that he's a virgin.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason. Because the
well, that's what the premise of the person they need to kill, right?
He's a virgin. Yeah. He's a virgin. Christ, so good.
That entire last sequence is heartbreaking.
Oh, it's really sad. It's really handled with, like, genuine, like... Because you've not liked him. He's like a stick-up-his-ass kind of, like...
Yeah.
You know, what do I was going to say he's peg in the mud. Yeah, he's literally a cop. But you really don't want him to die.
Mm.
The other line of Brian Eno's bio... Movies are either bad or good, so 5 stars or 0 stars. I really respect that.
That's something that would make my life easier.
Just do it. Yeah, maybe I think that's good. Here's the review. I have 2 major points to make here. I really relate to this movie because I'm bi and I live in the sewers and eat rats, and it's good to see some representation for once.
Yeah.
2, Tom Cruise can get it in this. I will not be taking questions.
Wonderful.
I don't know if I find him super hot, but I'm aware that I'm on my money outside.
I don't think he's that interested in being hot in this film, actually.
No.
Whether you find him hot or not, he's not. That's not what he's doing.
No. In fact, I think Cruise is one of those people who takes pleasure in ugly himself up a little bit. I think
that's definitely true.
I mean, that role in Tropic Thunder, right? Where he's got the big tummy and he's balding. Forgotten about that,
yeah.
Yeah, he's trying to do that. Manny Lazic. Do you know the Lazics?
I don't think so.
The Lazics are identical twin sister film critics. Two of the strongest and smartest voices working in contemporary film criticism. Okay. I've worked with Manny.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote an extraordinary piece on Brian De Palma's career for a magazine that I wrote. Top 4 films. The Talented Mr. Ripley. Have you seen it?
No.
It's good.
Okay.
It's pretty good. I made Brianna watch it recently and she was like, this is boring. And Wikipedia had the story ended halfway through. So, you know, A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers.
I really like that film.
Maybe the best Coen Brothers film.
I think that. Burn After Reading is...
The best one!
Maybe not.
No, I'm...
I don't know.
That would be a strong position and I would like
it. I think it might be true.
I think it's regarded for some people as like a minor
Coen. It definitely is. I think that's crazy.
That's interesting.
I think it's their clearest voice, definitely.
Wow.
I don't love... I mean, no. What other Coen... I've seen almost every Coen Brothers.
Have you seen Barton Fink?
Yeah, but a long time ago, and I've really wanted to rewatch it. Oh,
such a good
film. Yeah, I think that's...
Have you seen Blood Simple?
Yes.
Do you love Blood Simple?
Yeah.
So cruel, though. How could you like Blood Simple?
I like it. I mean, again, I saw it a very long time ago.
Yeah, I love it.
The Coens are too cruel for me.
I love their cruelty.
Yeah.
I love it. I don't think they've made a bad film. I think even the films that people shit on, like The Lady Killers.
Sure.
I think that's a
good film. I've only seen the original Lady Killers.
Original's a good film. It's a
very good film.
Alec Guinness is Ealing. So good in that film.
Yeah.
And also, kudos to Alec Guinness because he hates Star Wars.
Yeah, and it made him rich. Choice.
Yeah,
it
made him
rich. He took a percentage.
He hated it. The other Manny Lazic favourite films, The Naked Civil Servant. Do you know that
No.
film? It's about Quentin Crisp, like a very important queer voice. Yeah. It's pretty good. And Body Double, the Brian De Palma film. No. We know you haven't watched any De Palma.
Yeah.
You're going to America soon.
I am.
You could watch Body Double on the plane.
Okay.
It's got quite a lot of nudity in there.
Are you worried about people? Oh, I can watch it in a hotel.
CD.
Oh, that's not how I meant. Yeah.
Manny Lazic's interview with the vampire review. Tom Cruise is cruising through this camp, very 90s tale, having fun, his hair floating about and his beautiful pointy fake teeth shining. Brad Pitt hits rock bottom and gives nothing to his co-stars nor to the cameras beyond intense stupid looks and hair envy. I'm sad by that.
I get it.
I just had to bring that up because I don't agree with it. We've established. But, you know, it's a...
Diversity of views.
A lot of people I know think that.
I don't think he's as bad as everyone thinks, but I don't think he's great.
Antonio Banderas is a fun addition to the band with his overacting showing Brad how it's done. It's definitely true that Banderas is the one who just walks into the film and you're like, oh, he knows.
Yeah,
He's maybe out of all of the performers most in on the vision of that Jordan has. Mm. Whereas you could probably argue that Brad Pitt is playing the vision that Anne Rice has, which is very interesting. I just want to do two more.
Of course.
Is
that all right? Absolutely.
Nathan. She is a very good and prolific Letterboxd user who has, like, extremely good taste. Very... One of those people... The best thing to do on Letterboxd is to follow a couple of people who have very outlier taste and have a lot of knowledge of stuff. So they, if you just go through their five-star films, they will have stuff that you have never heard of. And you can find incredible discoveries that way. I wish Letterboxd paid me money to say shit like
that. You should. We should get them to sponsor the podcast.
Mm-hmm. I pay them money. The least they could do is give me my Patreon thing for free. Here we go. The four Nathan top films. I'll do it in the order of... You definitely haven't seen this till you have seen.
Excellent.
3-minute 1971 film called UFOs, which is a development of special color filters. It's like a test film to show off a color filter.
Okay, sure.
Have you seen it?
No. Apparently it's one of those on Netflix. A film that is made exclusively for... I think I heard about this on Blank Check, actually, or a podcast like that. A film that's made exclusively to, like, experiment with their streaming ability of, like, reducing or increasing data consumption.
Wow.
And so it's made with all these specific lighting and transitions, and it's very weird. Maybe I heard that about somewhere else.
That's so interesting. I'm going to look
that up. Yeah.
I mean, you found a Netflix hidden gem that I haven't seen yet, which is that short documentary, right? Where everyone's wearing masks.
Yeah.
What's that called? You should shout that out. Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. I'll look it up.
In the something.
Yeah. It's a very specific name because it's the name of a place and I don't remember the place. Keep reading Letterboxd reviews. I will listen and look up this.
Nathan's...
I bet it'll be nominated for an Oscar.
I mean, there's Oscar nominations coming soon. Nathan's second film, Suro Alien Hitchhiker. Have you seen that film?
Absolutely not. It'd
be pretty funny if you had. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid? Have you seen that?
No, actually.
The Sam Peckinpah film?
I could have seen that, but I have. Like, that would be one that it would be conceivable and that I've seen.
Pompeii, directed by Paul W.S. Anderson. Have you seen that?
No.
Fantastic.
You love Paul W.S. Anderson.
Have you found
the other Paul Anderson?
Have you found the name?
Yes. The documentary is Ghosts of Sugarland.
Ghosts of Sugarland.
And it is extraordinary. It's about... I mean, I won't say too much, but it's about a... town dealing with the loss of someone, essentially. But the thing that makes it transcendent is that all the people interviewed want to be anonymized, so they just wear these masks that you would love, like, bought from Walmart or whatever, like a Buzz Lightyear mask or an Iron Man mask, and they're just all sitting around in rooms chatting.
It works so well. It's amazing how there's a like sci-fi genre writer called Charles Beaumont who wrote these short stories. He was also like instrumental in the Twilight Zone. He co-wrote most of the great Twilight Zone episodes along with Rod Serling. And in describing him, Ray Bradbury was like, Charles was the master of coming up with these ideas that you just go like, ah. Like a Charles Beaumont story, for example, is like a traveler like goes into a monastery and finds a man underneath the monastery tied up who says, "The monks have captured me and tied me up. You have to help me." And the guy goes upstairs and sees the monks and is like, "Why do you have a guy kidnapped in your basement?" And the monks are like, "That's the devil." And there you go, right? Yeah, you make that. And similarly, a bunch of people are wearing like Iron Man masks talking about this tragedy.
Yeah.
You just go like, okay, well, I'm watching that film and it's probably pretty good on the strength of that idea.
Definitely.
Okay, two more. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I always sense like a... Not irritation, like you...
Not on my part.
You need to, like... I don't know, you don't love the Letterboxd.
No, I do, I do. That's just...
I'm having a crisis,
Dan. What do I love as much as you, Joseph? I love so many things, but your love is so pure and strong.
Fran Hoffner, who is a writer and editor.
I feel like I know that name.
She's incredible. She's a writer for Bright Wall, Dark Room. You should read...
Oh, yeah.
She wrote a piece on the Charlie XCX music video for Boys.
Hey, I'm going to use the beginning of the next decade briefly. I love that... song and music video. The two people in the 2010s that I was into years before they were popular are John Mulaney and Charlie XCX.
And you're it. I mean, those are big figures for the 2020s.
Yeah, and it was like maybe Charlie XCX I was into in 2012, and John Mulaney maybe like 2011.
You're a trendsetter, Daniel.
Well, no, Benson. but these are like. Very occasionally, you know, like you'll come across something. And I was obsessed with them. And I know that because I have bought both their... Like, I can look back through my iTunes receipts. And I had bought a Charlie XCX song from iTunes in, like, 2012. Nice. And John Mulaney's first album in, like, 2011. And I've just been thinking lately, well, I wonder what that says about me.
The key distinction. When they both started blowing up, did that cause you pleasure or irritation?
Pleasure, broadly.
You're a little bit like...
Yeah.
Okay.
But, although it's you kind of don't notice it as well. A similar thing happened with Lana Del Rey, actually.
I remember... We might
have talked about this.
Yeah, I was in England, and I remember picking up a magazine and being like... I must have been like 17. I was there on a holiday. And I was like, oh, this is the most beautiful person in the entire world.
That's interesting.
And it was Lana Del Rey, and nobody knew her. And I came back to Australia, and I was like, do you know this song, Video Games? It's really good.
Yeah. So yeah. I watched that when it was on like 300,000 views, because how it got popular was via a music blog that I used to read a lot called Gorilla vs. Bear. And it was like fed to them when she switched from Lizzie Grant to Lana Del Rey, I think, as like, well, we'll make this person seem underground.
I love Lana.
She's amazing. Video Games is one of the best 10 songs of the last 10 years.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Isn't it interesting that we intersect on her? Why do we intersect
on her? We intersect on a number of things.
I guess so. Music, not so much.
That's kind of true.
I don't love Frank Ocean.
That's wild to me. I was listening to Blonde yesterday, and it just so clearly to me is the like greatest album.
I don't
love Channel Orange. I think it's really good, but I think Blonde is just a sweeping, insane masterpiece.
It never cracked for me.
Interesting.
And Sufjan.
I'm all about Sufjan.
I'm sometimes a little bit.
He's my guy.
I don't see the project with Sufjan.
He's a weirdo.
I wish he was weirder.
He's pretty fucking weird.
He is weird. I don't like Carrie and Lowell. I don't like.
Yeah, that's my favorite album of the last 10 years.
It's one of Brianna's too.
Yeah, it's just every choice.
It's too. Perfect. It's like wallpaper or something.
It's so moving to me. Just an entire harmony between lyric and melody and production and just constantly extraordinarily moving.
It sounds like an auditory Hallmark card. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I like it too much to be dissuaded. I think maybe I am more interested in minor variations on a theme than you are. I think I'm really happy to have something humble presented and then like little twists and shifts. And you want fucking explosions.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like that's not... That's just...
No.
I mean, we could trace the whatever respective trauma led to those preferences, but I think that might be part of it.
I think that's true.
Mm.
Friends top four films. In the Loop. Have you seen
it? I love In the Loop. I for a long time, I would have said The Thick of It was my favorite television show.
It's a good show.
Of all shows.
It's a good show.
I'm not sure if I still am holding that position, but I still think it's perfect, basically.
Gandolfini is so good in In the Loop.
Oh my god.
What a talent.
One of our masters.
Yeah, truly. We lost someone extremely special. Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, I don't want to compare responses to trauma and sadness and death, but, like, people are very sad about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
I see that. I'm very sad about Hoffman. Philip Seymour. I love Hoffman, too, but, like, Gandolfini was at the same level. He just wasn't respected by the Academy in the same way.
Yeah, that's true.
Hoffman was, like, lauded, and I think Gandolfini was like, oh, he's the TV guy. He's the
gangster.
Yeah, who, like, occasionally awkwardly makes his way into movies. No, he's never not incredible.
Mm.
In fact, we'll get to it, because he's in the best film of the last decade, Killing Them Softly, in one of the standout performances in that film.
Okay.
Friends are a league of their own. You know what? I've never seen that film.
Neither have I. That's interesting.
Directed by Penny Marshall. Okay. I should really watch that.
Yeah, check it out.
A Room with a View, the James Ivory film.
No.
Very poor.
Is that Merchant Ivory?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's your kryptonite Merchant Ivory, I imagine.
Absolutely is. Do you know a quick story sidebar? I mean, he's a dickhead, right? But the story has stuck with me for a reason. Quentin Tarantino was introducing Reservoir Dogs at a screening. He would just, because he was an egomaniac, he would just go to like regular screenings and say to the operators, "I'm Quentin Tarantino, I directed this movie, let me go up and introduce
it."
Very
funny.
And before Reservoir Dogs, he stood up and he was like getting the crowd G'd up. Mm-hmm. And he was like, "Who loves Bruce Lee movies, and a bunch of people went like, woo, and he was like, who loves horror movies? And everyone was like, woo, and he was like, who loves black exploitation movies? And everyone was like, woo, and he was like, who loves Merchant Ivory movies? And a couple of people to expecting to be like applauded were like, woo, and he was like, get the fuck out. I agree with that stance. Fran's fourth and final film, Force Majeure.
I love that film.
I knew you would love that film if you had seen it. If you hadn't, you would love it.
Yeah.
Because it's about...
Insecure masculinity?
No, but I mean, yes, also. What's your favourite thing? I cracked this about you recently. You might have said it. In reference to Hoojibwuzzy from True Romance.
You
love idiots.
Oh, yeah, I love idiots. And it's about an idiot.
It's about an idiot.
Yeah.
You know they're remaking that film?
It's called, what, Snow Day or something?
It's like Downhill.
That's right. Fuck off.
Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
I mean, I like Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I like Will Ferrell enough. I think Julia Louis-Dreyfus is great.
I think Will Ferrell has burnt himself out on my goodwill.
Definitely. That's totally fair.
Step Brothers, a masterpiece, an American
masterpiece. I mean, although that's all about Adam Scott and, what's his name?
John C. Reilly.
No, actually, Richard... Oh, the dad.
Yeah, Richard Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins.
Unbelievable.
It's a fun film with John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell. Richard Jenkins and Adam Scott make it cinema.
I don't know if I agree with that, but they are the icing on a particularly important and delicious cake.
I want more Adam Scott.
If he's misused, he can be like too much of a bro.
Sure.
And I feel alienated from him. I can imagine him being very rude to me in public.
Well, he's also got a great podcast called You Talk and You Too to Me with Scott Aukerman.
You know why I think I have this issue with him?
Yeah, huh?
You know this story.
Yeah, I do.
The listener doesn't know this story. Dan's kind of like embedded in podcasts in a way that I'm not.
I've been listening since like 2009.
Yeah, you know.
To like, LA comedy podcasts especially.
Yeah, you just know that world in a way that I don't. I remember when I first heard about these podcasts and the name that kept coming up was like this Scott Aukerman guy. And I was like, oh, I wonder who that is. I'll search him on Twitter. Never interacted with him.
Mm.
No idea of who he is. He blocked me. I was blocked by Scott Aukerman. That's a
very assonant phrase.
I'm not... It is, actually. I was blocked rhyme. By Scott. What could I say?
I don't know.
I don't have contentious opinion. I mean, I do have contentious opinion. Yeah.
The listeners of this podcast will disagree. I don't know. It must be like...
niche contentious...
Block list, tagged in something.
You know what I think it is? And this is my revenge. I was very rude publicly about Ryan Adams before he got cancelled because Ryan Adams, the musician, was extremely rude to me and I was like, he's the most unpleasant person I've ever interviewed. And that was around the time, so I bet Scott Aukerman and Ryan Adams are friends.
I've met Scott Aukerman. I got him to autograph something outside a hotel in Santa Monica like 7 years ago.
Didn't you tell me that he...
It was nice.
He like wore his sunglasses in a first meeting with a Hollywood Handbook guy.
Oh, this now we're really getting into podcast politics. Yeah, I think he wore
his sunglasses. Let's wage war on Scott
Aukerman. No, I'm not. I am not part of that. Like, he's a real gatekeeper in terms of who is in comedy right now.
And I think that's a bad thing.
Okay, well, look...
Didn't he direct the Between Two Ferns movie?
Yeah. He directed all the Between Two Ferns shorts.
It's a little bit embarrassing.
I think he also wrote Shark Tale 2, but anyway, maybe. Or, like, punched it up or something. I feel like he's talked about that.
Friends review. And then I'll do two more or one more?
Up to you.
No, Dan, sometimes it looks like I'm an acting torturer.
No, I'm so sorry my face is doing that to you.
Fran, his review is maybe the best one so far. I'm also always mad at my one friend.
That's lovely.
That's the film, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
All right, here we go. I saw two more good ones, so I'm going to do at least the
Which
two.
Which of million. Us is Lestat and Louis? Which is Louis?
Saying... It's very insulting to say that someone's Louis, right? Because you're just saying they're nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
You're saying you're the bit part to my like feature-length presentation, basically.
But Louis is Brad Pitt's first build. Is he? Actually, maybe he isn't.
Which one of us is Bert and which one's Ernie?
That's a better question.
That's way easier.
I've always been obsessed with the Bert and Ernie sketch. I think of it all the time where Bert asks Ernie why he has all those strings on his finger. And he says, I've got the string on this finger to remind me I have string on this finger. So why do you have string on that finger? Oh, to remind me I have string on this finger. He goes through like all 10 fingers. And when he gets to the final finger, he's like, why do you have string on that finger? And Ernie says, to remind me that we're out of string.
That's a good joke. I'm Ernie and you're Bert.
Okay.
Do you not agree?
I don't know.
I think that's true.
That might be. Bert's such a killjoy.
No, but you're just, you're more sensible.
That's
than
probably
I am.
True. I want things to be, yeah.
Which Muppet are you then? I know which Muppet I am. You have, no, you go on. And
Fozzie
then I'll
Bear?
Tell you. Maybe.
Well, not sweet enough.
I was going to say Kermit. Kind.
Sad.
A little bit sad. But kind. What would you say the defining trait of Kermit is? He's kind.
He's kind. I appreciate that.
Who am I?
I'm fine with being Kermit. Animal? No, that was...
That would be pretty good.
That would be pretty good.
I think I'm Rolf the dog.
Oh, that's great. It's been a long time since I've really immersed myself in the Muppets, which is why I'm hesitating, I think. But Rolf's great.
Have you seen the first Muppets movie?
No.
The
one with, like,
Jason Segel.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that.
There is a... I know. I'll be quick. There's like a getting the band back together montage in that film,
okay,
where they like go and find all the Muppets and they're all doing like different quirky things,
yeah,
and they get them to go on the road tour. And then the montage finishes and Rolf the dog goes up to Kermit. Not Kermit. It's like led by a... There's this new puppet called Walter who's
okay,
the main character. And Rolf goes up to Walter and he's like, hey, why didn't you show what happened to me when you guys came and found me in that montage? And they're like, oh, because it wasn't very interesting. And you cut to them walking up to Rolf, who's in a hammock, and they're like, hey, wanna come with us? And Rolf's like, okay.
Very sweet. I love it.
Extremely funny. Would you like to see... Okay, would you like to see a very positive review or a very not positive review?
I want to hear a positive review.
Okay. You want to hear, like, 5 stars?
Yeah.
Okay, this person's called... Naughty.
Okay.
Top 4 films. Train to Busan. Have you seen that?
No.
South Korean zombie film.
Yeah.
Everybody loves that film. It's okay. If you're going to watch, like, train films, sci-fi dystopian train films, watch Snowpiercer.
Yeah, sure.
Good film. The Creepy Line.
Nope.
2018. Whoa. An eye-opening documentary, The Creepy Line, reveals the stunning degree to which society is manipulated by Google and Facebook.
I mean, true,
I mean,
but also
is.
Sounds like a conspiracy.
Yeah,
yeah,
it sounds like you're doing something. The Beyond, directed by Lucio Fulci.
Don't
Do you know
it.
Fulci? Madman, Italian horror director. The last one, First Reformed.
Oh, yeah. Solid
a film. That unsettles you.
Deeply, yeah. I thought it was pretty good.
I think it's a masterpiece.
Sure.
Although it's just ripped off from 2 different films.
Yeah.
This is a 5-star film. I love these reviews. These are my favorite kind. Cruise and Pitt with it. Lots of exclamation marks. Cruise and Pitt were the ultimate yin-yang. Pitt was the kindling and Cruise was the fire. When Cruise was absent from the film, the edginess and engrossing aspects of the film took a dive. Exclamation mark. It took the mysterious and sultry Banderas to pump life back into the film, but that was short-lived and leads to one of my biggest complaints. Exclamation mark. Pitt and his melancholy was great for the central character's tone and for the narration of the story. Exclamation mark. But it needed to be balanced by either Cruise or Banderas' more animated and exciting personas. Exclamation mark. Banderas was not used to the film's advantage, exclamation mark. His was an enchanting character and should have played a much larger part in the film, exclamation mark. Initially, I despised the ending, feeling it was out of place, but after a while it made perfect sense, exclamation mark, and left the door wide open for the potential of a sequel, exclamation mark. Overall, a strong entry in the vampire genre, exclamation mark.
Very.
4.5 stars.
Oh, I love it. Overall, a strong entry.
2 more? Last 2? For
last
real?
Last 1.
2.
Okay.
What are we at?
An hour and 33. It's okay.
Dan needs to go to America. That's
yeah, I gotta get prepared.
Not now.
Well, so
that'd be pretty funny.
That would
be very mean
to
be like, Dan, I'd come with you to the airport. We'd sit in the lobby and record it together. We should do that. I mean, our ambient outside episode was the
craziest
thing
we've
ever
done.
Yeah, I like
it. We should vary location more.
Early in the podcast, we talked about going to other people's houses. Maybe we should do that.
Just turn up.
Mia, top 4 films. Mia's bio is, I am that very witch. Do you know what that's a line from?
No.
The new Suspiria.
Oh.
I am that very
well
witch.
Well remembered.
Top 4 films. Inland Empire. Have you seen it?
I think I saw half of it and
it's
didn't finish it.
It's very long.
It's really long. I have it on DVD.
This is a controversial take. David Lynch was very excited about finding digital. And he was like, I'm never shooting on film again. And the reason why I love digital is I can do anything.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
You know, I can just shoot endlessly. I can shoot as much as I want. Bad for him as an artist.
Yeah, he needs restriction, definitely.
He needs to not be able to...
But, yeah.
do all of his ideas.
So Blue Velvet was so good. It had to be 2 hours.
Yeah. And also,
it's exactly 2 hours.
Also so controversial, but I think Blue Velvet is his best film, one of the all-time great films, because he's working in a very strict genre and narrative restriction.
I agree. I don't know if I agree that it's his best, but I agree that that's the reason why it's good.
Well, I mean, even if you wanted to say Twin Peaks Season 3, which is like one of your most beloved artistic objects, that too has like very precise restrictions.
Definitely.
That really work for it.
Yeah, I agree.
The other three films. Melancholia. Yeah, I haven't seen it. Have you seen any Von Trier?
Yeah, Dogville. We've had this conversation on the podcast, I think.
We talked about Von Trier
before. Yeah, I've seen Dogville, maybe one other film, I can't remember which.
Didn't like Dogville? Because it was on a cruel punchline?
I mean, I probably didn't like the cruelty, but I don't remember, a long time ago, but I remember liking it enough.
Persona?
The Ingmar haven't seen Bergman it, really film? Want to.
You gotta do...
Yeah, I gotta go through all Bergman. I love The Seventh Seal, it's one of my favourite films.
Really?
Yeah, I fucking love that movie.
I don't know what you'll think about a lot of Bergman. He can be...
Oh, I also saw... Yeah, I didn't like film two people on a boat at the end. It's one word. It's
Shame?
Yeah, I didn't like Shame.
You didn't like Shame?
Too sad. Just nothing redeeming.
Shame's maybe one of my favourites.
Yeah.
And the fourth one, High Life.
I loved High Life.
You really did like that film.
Yeah,
it was one of the happiest times I've ever seen Dan is you after that film.
I was so charged up by it.
You really were. We saw it in the State Theatre, which is the worst venue in Sydney.
No, but we didn't have terrible seats, though.
We didn't. You could hear the trains rumbling underneath your feet. That's true. Mia's 3-star review. Gay rights. Fantastic review. I love that.
Sure.
All right, here you go. Last one. Mm-hmm. I promise.
That's okay.
Top 4 films. I think you've seen every one of these films.
Okay.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
I like it.
Amelie.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even know what I think of that film. I might have seen it twice.
I don't know what I think of that film. I mean, Letterboxd is handy because I can click on it. I could... When I first got Letterboxd, I went through every film I'd seen and I've rated it, so I haven't done these ratings in a while. I could imagine that I either gave Amelie, like, anywhere from, like, 1 to 4 stars.
Sure, yeah, that
makes sense to me. I gave it 3.
Okay. Interesting.
It's a fucking weird film.
It is weird.
Have you seen Janae and Tattoo's other film, A Very Long Engagement?
No.
Way better.
Okay.
Amelie is just like, it's crazy that that film came out in the months before September 11th. Like, if that film came out 4 months later, it doesn't get released in America. Post 9/11 American audiences do not want to see that film.
That's interesting.
Don't you think?
I don't remember enough about it to say, honestly, but maybe.
It's like a frothy fairy tale. I mean,
but that's what people think Paris is, right? Maybe they do want it because it's escapism.
I guess so. But I think it's not insignificant that one of the biggest blockbusters of like the immediate post 9/11 is Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
Sure.
Which is a film that directly trades on all of that imagery.
Yeah, that's true.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I don't love it.
Do you not?
No. I, again, saw it once very long time ago. Yeah. I remember you not loving it.
Really?
I'm sure I could go back and really like it.
I kind of felt that would be a Dan film.
I know. People do. Same with Adaptation.
You don't like Adaptation?
Not really.
I think that's even more of a Dan film. I know.
Me too.
You don't like Kaufman then?
I saw Synecdoche, New York twice and was like, finally, a Kaufman that I love. I tried to watch it again recently and didn't feel it.
Oh, I love that film.
I would have said consistently it was one of my favourite movies. But watching it and I was like, is it?
I think it's like a 4.5 star film. I would have said 5. Wrecks me.
I know, me too. Wrecks me. Yeah.
Were you watching it at home and you kind of like drifted in and drifted out? Were you showing it to someone?
No, it was just me.
I think that film, you need to get forced into its rhythm.
So, yeah, I watched it at the cinema. I took my dad. I think I saw it at the cinema with someone, then took dad to see it at the cinema.
What did your dad think?
He liked it. But again, a long time ago.
Sure.
When it was at the cinema.
Fourth film. I know you like this director. I will be interested to see what you say. I think it's his worst film. Second worst film. Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh, I liked Moonrise Kingdom enough. Yeah.
I think that film is a mess. What is that film about?
Bill Murray?
I guess so.
I don't know, yeah.
That's a problem.
I know, yeah. It was fun.
You know the kid from that film, Jared Gilroy, is like very big on film Twitter.
Oh, really?
He's grown up and he's like a film Twitter. I shouldn't call him a shit poster. He's a good boy.
He and the girl from that film are in Paterson on the bus. There's a scene on the bus and these two students are talking to each other about like Italian politics and it's them.
Really? Mm-hmm. That is a bizarre Jarmusch choice.
Yeah.
Do you think they're friends, Jim Jarmusch and Wes Anderson?
I reckon they are.
I mean, Wes Anderson cribs a lot from Jarmusch.
Sure.
That, why would he do that?
It's a fun gesture. I don't know.
What did you think of Paterson?
7.5 out of 10.
Oh, that's high.
Yeah, I had problems, but I liked it.
It's real misogynistic.
Oh, sure. It's also kind of racist.
Yeah.
There need to be more movies about poets, though, you know. If there were more movies about poets, maybe I wouldn't like it as much.
I did love that Adam Driver very deadpan says to the dog, "I don't like you."
That's a great scene.
I mean, that'll do it for me. Erica. A family can be two dramatic vampire dads and their angry little vampire daughter.
Yeah.
4 stars.
Beautiful.
The one thing I was going to say, to wrap up, this is a good thing. Rice turns down the homoeroticism in the film adaptation.
Oh.
The book is way queerer and, a lot more kind of hot and heavy stuff.
Interesting.
And by all accounts, that's her decision. That's not the studios telling her that she has to tone it down.
Okay, that's fascinating. So I guess that suggests something about her own trajectory.
It is interesting. Yeah, well, that's the back and forth with Christianity thing. I think she's one of those people who sometimes has, a degree of, distaste for what she has spawned.
Hmm.
Wouldn't that suck? Literally.
Yo, man, if the thing that makes you popular is the philosophy you've turned on.
The fucking cartoonist who made Pepe the Frog. Hijacked, and then he has to kill Pepper.
I mean, it could happen to any of us. What are they going to do with the Brad Pitt
cast? Oh, don't. Fucking God damn it. Final words.
Here, actually, before final words, here's something I want to say.
Go on, please do.
It seems like people are listening, for which we are extremely grateful. Rate us on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. Give us a review. We'll be very grateful. You don't have to give us five stars.
You know, when I listen to podcasts and they say, give us 5 stars, I understand it helps the algorithm, but I'm nothing if not self-destructive. Okay,
evaluate us.
Give a true evaluation.
Yeah, is this a 4-star podcast?
Ooh. Or even you saying those words is going to keep me up at night.
3.5.
I'd want to be, like Brian Eno says, 5 or 0.
Just give us 5 stars. Leave a review. Email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com. What you like, what you don't like. Who's your favourite? Don't say that.
Oh, who's your favourite? Dan and I will be it'll be like audition. We'll be sitting in front of the computer on the ground watching the screen.
Yeah, it is thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Tell us if you disagree that the Bert and Ernie dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, we may have more specific things to email about in the future, but I feel like we haven't plugged the email in a while. Anything else? Tell your friends, I guess.
Tell your friends.
Yeah.
This would have been more sensible in the Christmas episode, but I'm going to say it now. This podcast is a great source of joy to me.
Yeah, likewise.
I really imagined that it would be fun to do the podcast, but no one would really listen.
Oh, that people are listening. Also, actually, something else with the email. We can see, who knows if people are using VPNs or whatever, but we seem to be getting some listeners in some strange places. If you're listening and you're not, a local in Sydney or listening from somewhere afar, please let us know. Let us know how you found us.
Dan has a sneaking suspicion that some of you are robots.
I mean, I don't know. Just there's some surprising countries is all.
You know, a thing that we've said before, but it's worth repeating again. People like Brad Pitt.
It's true. Yeah, they're not here for us.
Because I tweet quite a lot, not as much as I should on the Brad Pitt cast account, and I follow people.
Mm.
There is a subculture of Brad Pitt stans, 18, 19.
Interesting.
Do you know an interesting thing? I don't think they'd like this podcast.
I bet not.
I think we're too critical
of Brad Pitt. Need to be more. I mean, maybe as time goes on, I think we are.
I love him.
Obviously, both of us do.
Do you know what this podcast has solidified for me?
Your love of Brad Pitt?
There's no performer I like to see on the screen more.
That's interesting. I might. Well, I would have to reflect on it more.
Actually, there is one. But
Tom Cruise?
No. We have to have this conversation off mic at some point, because I realized the other day, in my head it's just an eventuality, but I haven't really properly discussed with you. I saw The Counselor the other day.
Great film.
And Cameron Diaz popped up, and I'm like, this Diaz is my other.
Interesting. We'll work it out. Who knows what the future holds?
Who knows what the future holds? Dan's going to America.
I'm going to America.
By the time you listen to this, he's in America. Yeah. He's wandering the New York streets. Maybe. Dressed in a coat, eating a bagel.
Definitely.
Are you going to sightsee some Brad Pitt locations?
Oh, I could. I could take some photos for the podcast. What are the locations?
Interview with the Vampire was shot in San Francisco, which I'm not going to.
I've been to San Francisco. That's interesting. That makes sense.
Where would you go in Seattle?
That's
music. That's Kurt Cobain's.
Yeah.
Find
I'm going to Boston as well.
If you find anything Brad Pitt adjacent,
I'll bring it back or take a photo.
Take a photograph of yourself. Definitely. If you find anything at all.
Okay. I promise. I'll think overtime about
even
it.
Even a gym that looks like the gym in Burn After Reading.
Or cutting class. What's the? Oh, you can hear Ida panting in the background.
I know. It's looking at me weird. Are you all right?
She wants. She's doing okay.
What's up? She's on codeine right now. She looks. You know what I said to Brianna? I'm sorry. I know we're wrapping up. I said to Brianna yesterday when we were watching Interview with the Vampire, Ida is kind of... Ida would fit into that film. Greyhounds are kind of vampires.
Yeah.
She's a little bit less stabbed.
That's true. She's Oh, that's true. The sharpness of her face.
And she's currently propped up on a pillow staring at us. She looks a bit like a retiring vampiric aristocrat. Fangs. She's got fangs. You're right.
I enjoyed the film. I really did. I'm glad I did. I'm
so glad. Next time we meet, we will be doing Legends of the Fall.
I don't know anything about it. I literally know nothing about it. Have you seen it?
And unbelievably boring.
Maybe I'll try to watch it on the plane.
But I think it's a good idea to watch it on the plane.
Okay.
And maybe, no, I mean, we can decide, but it might add a much-needed frisson onto that episode if we recorded it while you were jet-lagged.
Because we've got to have something. Yeah. Okay. Right, get off the plane, come to record.
Yeah, do it. I'll meet you at the airport. We'll record in the taxi.
In the lounge, yeah.
On the way, yeah.
All right.
Thanks so much for listening.
Hey. Thank you.
Rate and review and subscribe. Subscribe on Spotify. Listen iTunes, wherever Apple you like. We're available on any podcast network that you choose.
And we look forward to seeing you next time.
That was a week ending.
Should we quickly, just very quickly, check the Golden Globes? Are they happening right now?
Oh, fuck, shit. Yes. The Golden Globes are happening today, so that dates the podcast.
But it may not have...
It might not, because the Golden Globes go forever.
Ricky Gervais.
I know.
We love him.
Oh, Ricky.
Okay, I think we've just... Oh, Best Foreign Language Film winner is predictable.
Oh, is it? I gotta look now.
I'm very happy about the Best Drama Series.
Hang on. We got to announce these things. Okay. Parasite just won Best Foreign Language Film. Yeah, unpredictable. Very predictable. That film will be nominated for Best Picture and Best Director. Yeah. And Bong Joon-ho might win Director.
Rami Youssef,
the star of that show that none of us have seen. And then the Guardian coverage just says, "It begins," and it's a photo of Ricky Gervais's face.
Nightmare. We don't. This podcast is against Ricky Gervais.
There's few people I dislike as much as Ricky Gervais. On that note.
Yeah. See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.